Hello and welcome to the Umbrella Hour. The Umbrella Hour is hosted by Dr. Ann Goldbauer, a clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, that's me, a licensed clinical social worker. The Umbrella Hour features insightful and provocative and inspiring interviews that examine the lives of LGBT people from diverse vantage points. Dr. Ann Goldbauer is on holiday, and he will be back in our next episode. So let's go ahead and get started. Our guest today is Michael Woodward, an early leader in the gender justice movement. And most notably, he contributed the title essay to the iconic 2014 transmasculine anthology, Manning Up, Transsexual Men on Finding Brotherhood, Family, and Themselves, published by Transgress Press. We'll be talking about that for sure. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Well, hey there. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. So when I know the guest personally, I typically make that known to the listener. And then we try and figure out between us, you and I, when did we meet? Where did we meet? Do you remember when and where we met first?
Well, there's a couple possibilities. I'm guessing it was at a conference, probably a transmasculine conference, probably in the early aughts, either Washington, D.C. or Seattle. I want to say Seattle, but I'm not positive.
I think so. I'm thinking Gender Odyssey.
Yep.
In Seattle, Washington. My first year there was 2006, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right.
And yeah. I went every year for 10 years, but not really because 1 year it was canceled. So I went 9 times in 10 years.
Yeah. I only went that one time and early on. But then, as you probably remember, I got a job with Aiden as the conference director. So then I went several times.
Yes, you did.
I didn't have to go to the conference. I was just kind of there running around with my head cut off. So,
yes. Well, then you bring up Aiden. So for the listener, we interviewed Aiden Key recently. So hopefully you've listened to that episode and learned more about Aiden and his work in the community. There's a lot to go through because you're like me. When we were asking you to write the bio, you were like, it's hard to condense so much of life. And I'm the same way. I'm like, if somebody were to ask me to write a full bio of my life and my experience, it would be a book, right?
Right.
It can't be condensed. So I appreciate that you went through the painstaking effort to reduce it. But when you say that you are the executive director and also a co-founder of an organization, now, is Traction a national organization or a Washington state organization?
Well, we are based in Washington, but we're a virtual organization and we aspire to be national. We're still fairly new and small, but the projects that we're working on don't necessarily have to be tied to Washington. They can be nationwide types of campaigns and things. A lot of it kind of depends on our funding and where we can direct things, resources. They may need to stay in the state if the funder is Washington based and that type of thing. But there's plenty of things that we're doing that are broader than that. So,
okay. Let's go back in time. So as a leader of the gender justice movement, why don't you give us a trip down memory lane? What were some of your earliest involvements in gender justice movement? I know it hasn't always called that. What were some of the organizations you were involved in or just some of the activities you were involved in? What were you doing over the course of this period? And when did that start? How many years are we going back now?
Well, I mean, if you want to go back to even before I transitioned, we're talking late 80s, early 90s. And I was very involved in the women's music scene in Indianapolis, where I grew up and came out and transitioned. We were the host of the National Women's Music Festival, which was the indoor one, not the one outdoors with all the camping. But that's what was happening in Indianapolis. And I got real involved in that first as a volunteer. And then I was on the board and I never performed there or anything, but I cut my teeth as a organizer and learned about boards and things like that, being involved with that organization for 15 years. And then right after I retired from the presidency of the board is when I discovered my transness. And that was an interesting time to change my name and my gender and my pronouns and still be called the past president of the National Women's Music Festival. And there was a lot of separatists that were involved. It got a little dicey. But overall, the work I did there was the work I did and had a tense for a little while, but it's all good now. So, and I still have friends from back then.
Oh, good. It does make sense. I mean, I was involved in lesbian community organizing mm-hmm. for many years. And it's one of those things where it's a part of my background. It's a part of my life experience that isn't as easily brought up. It's like, how do I, just in casual conversation, I'm having a conversation with somebody about doing political action or being involved in community-based organizations, say, oh yeah, you know, well, I founded two lesbian Avengers chapters.
Right.
You know,
exactly. Yeah.
That doesn't really sound right. What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know, similar story, but it's what I was doing then. And I'm still who I am. So, you know, I still claim that part of my life. And I lived as an out dyke for 20 years before I knew that trans men was a thing. And I was 36 before I was able to figure that out, thanks to another masculine estrogen bodied person who kind of pulled me aside one day and said, hey, I want to let you know that I'm changing my name from Holly to Holling, and I'm going to start taking testosterone, and my voice is going to get deeper, and I'm going to start growing hair on my face, and I'm going to start living as a man. And I was like, you can do that? Oh my God, I had no idea. Yes. And probably started my transition about 5 minutes later. So yeah. And that was in like 97 or 98. So,
you know, there's been a lot of talk, you know, within FTM community, for those of you who don't know the lingo FTM, that's sort of a colloquial way of talking about trans men. FTM right. stands for female to male. It's not really as commonly used, but it's still used among guys that I know. We still say FTM sure. all the time because it's shorthand. A lot of us came from lesbian community, so we were exposed to drag culture. So we saw female impersonation. We saw drag shows. I was more androgynous. I wasn't like the uber masculine women. I knew them. They were around me all the time. It didn't really dawn on me. It was the same. Like, oh, I could take testosterone and I could start living in the world like socially as a man. Eventually, I started to meet trans men, but it still didn't make sense to me to a certain degree. I don't know if you can relate to it. I had an acquaintance who went from Christine to Chris to Christopher. Went from Christine to Chris, moved to San Francisco, and then did their transition and came back about a year and a half later. And there was something clearly more masculine about them, but I didn't understand what was happening. And then when I ran into them a few years later with the beard and the mustache, oh, what are you doing? In college, I had met a trans guy, but I found him really obnoxious. I was somewhat separatist. I still had that notion of, okay, so you want to live in the world as a man, but do you have to be that kind of man? Putting your feet up on the table in the front of the room in a classroom during a LGBT panel that I organized.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So there was a sense in which I was a little unsure what Christopher was doing, and I didn't really like what this other guy was doing, and it kind of put me off of the whole thing for about another 6 or 7 years, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because this was, of course, before the internet really took hold and before Facebook and all those kinds of things. But even in high school, I remember, well, so I was always a tomboy, of course, but my mom never really thought that was too unique or anything because one of her best friends in high school or something was a tomboy. I have no idea what happened to that person after high school. But so she didn't really think too much about it, about me wanting army toys and footballs and things like that for Christmas. And same time she wanted me to be super girly, but I just wasn't. But over time, by the time I got to college, I was really struggling with trying to figure out why I couldn't be feminine. I was trying to be feminine and I just failed at it miserably. And when I went to college, the first thing I did was lose my purse and grabbed a backpack and never picked up a purse again. I made it all the way through college as a butch and then presented as butch for another decade or so until I met Holling. And it just totally made sense to me right in the moment as soon as he said, and I'm going to start living as a man. Mm. And holy crap, you really can do that. I'd never even, you know, like you said, I knew a couple of queens. I knew one who had transitioned and was living full-time as a woman, but I didn't know her very well. We had partied together a couple times and stuff like that. But the only other trans people that I knew were these two trans women who were good friends, and they ran around together. But they were both, like you said, kind of obnoxious personalities, and I just didn't really like spending time with them. So I didn't really get to know them, and I didn't know anyone who was out as trans masculine or as FTM. And so when I finally got this information, light bulb, the epiphany happen. And then it was really just a matter of being in the Midwest and figuring out how to transition. It wasn't ever me trying to figure myself out per se. As soon as I had the answers, I shouldn't say that because I spent a lot of time miserable psychologically. But yeah, I guess I didn't question my transness once I knew that that's what it was and was knew I was able to pursue it. So
absolutely. That's how I was too. I was like, oh, okay. And yep. Then I was on the road. What you're talking about is a lack of visibility.
Yes, exactly.
Of trans men as we were coming up. And it probably wouldn't surprise you, and you might even be thinking about this already on a fairly regular basis, that invisibility is still with us. There's still a lack of visibility of, I guess, using today's parlance, I'll say binary trans men. Right. Mm-hmm. That would be the way people would talk about it now.
Yep.
That's still the issue. When Jameson Green wrote Becoming a Visible Man, and then when he updated his book, 20 years later, the invisibility is still an issue.
It truly is.
Yes. Yeah. Now for you, you got involved in FTM community, which to a certain degree created a kind of visibility. So you want to talk a little bit about you stepped away from being on the board with the women's music organization, and now you're starting your transition. What kinds of leadership or involvement did you do when you were in your early transition days and then going forward?
So about a year and a half or so after I started transitioning, I moved to Tucson, Arizona. Left Indiana where I'd grown up and family was and everything and all my support system was, and took the big step of wandering out into the world. Okay, Arizona looks pretty good. At the time, I didn't realize how conservative it really was, but Tucson actually was pretty blue. And I actually, at that point, I really wasn't even that aware of politics in general. I was focused on mostly women's stuff. But the longer I was there, the more I woke up and look around. Oh my God. Growing up in a conservative area, you don't realize how conservative things are until you leave there. And when I left Indiana, so Arizona at the time was, at least in my perception, and Tucson was much, much more liberal than anywhere in Indiana. And of course, now I live in Seattle, so that puts it all to shame. But one of the reasons I chose to move to Tucson was there was already an organization there called the Southern Arizona Gender Alliance. And the thing that I thought was really cool about that actually was that it was not just a men's group or a women's group. It was actually everybody met together on the first Monday. And then the second week, the trans guys would meet, third week, the trans, however it broke down. So that alliance was really important to me because I've always been a joiner and an organizer and trying to bring people together to get things done. And I really saw that as unique because in Indianapolis, we barely had the Indy Boys that just started, and there wasn't a women's group that I knew of. There probably was, but there wasn't the equivalent support groups and all that stuff that the Indy Boys had built. So when I moved to Tucson, the reason I chose Tucson in particular was because of this group there and the LGBT community center. Indianapolis didn't have a community center, so I was all gaga over the LGBT center, which at the time was still calling itself the Gay and Lesbian Center. And they had literally used whiteout on their t-shirts to write in the word transgender. Then they finally bought some new t-shirts, but it was funny at the time. Because Saga was a unique organization and because of the alliance, it brought us a little extra attention. And I went to a lot of conferences and stuff, and I was talking about Saga and everything. So we became known as one of the more active groups in the Southwest for trans folks and being in Tucson, because Tucson actually added gender identity and sexual orientation to it, well, just gender identity, to its city ordinances way back in 2000, which was super early on. I mean, they're like one of the number 16 or something out of municipalities to do that. I started going to a lot of conferences as part of my work with Saga, started meeting a lot of other trans men like yourself and Jameson and all those folks out there that we've met over the years. I don't know. I just end up in charge of things because nobody else wants to do it, I guess. So yeah, I mean, I've been on several different boards and special events and been a speaker places and done lots and lots and lots of training and having conversations with cis folks about gender identity. And this was before our community made it a little more complicated around pronouns and stuff for cis people. And I'm not judging that in any way. I'm just saying it used to be an easier conversation than it is now. And people would always say, you know, I never really thought of it that way. Or just the way I would explain it to people and do my trainings really, really helped change their mind about things. And so that inspired me to start making this more of a career. And so I was doing some consulting and actually ended up going back to grad school and getting a master's in public health so that I could have extra letters after my name so I could get in some boardrooms instead of just in front of students. And I got invited to some trans-led media trainings and national things that activists get invited to after a while. And then I moved to Seattle and disappeared.
It happens.
But, yeah, exactly. And that's okay because it was time for a break. And then now I'm back with Traction and I'm the only trans guy involved and have been all along of all the founders and everybody. A lot of my just involvement in community came from me not wanting to give up my LGBT-ness, also realizing that there just weren't a lot of trans people at gay and lesbian events. And I was still felt very queer and probably was more so after I transitioned because then I started identifying as bi. But I made it a point to continue my LGBT activism and working on projects that were not just trans focused because that inclusion, the visibility, had I met a trans man when I was 21 or 16, probably would have tried to transition then, but might have had more resistance from my folks at that point. That was a lot.
No, I love it. I love hearing stories. You mentioned Indie Boys, and if my recollection is correct, you let me know. You were part of, if not instrumental, in the formation of AmBoys or American Boys, right? B-O-Y-Z. Is that correct, or am I off?
Indie Boys, the group being...
No, AmBoys, the big national group.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know the history of AmBoys.
Oh, okay.
I felt like they were around the same time and that maybe Holling would be able to answer this question because Holling's the founder of Indie Boys, which I don't think it's even called Indie Boys anymore, but whatever they're called now.
Yeah, because I remember there were Desert Boys. I lived in Tucson also. I founded the Lesbian Avenger chapter there in 1994.
You probably knew Carolyn then,
I used to go to Wingspan, which is the LGBT center.
Yep. I worked there for 7 years after I got there. That was Saga became part of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember hearing all about that. I was already gone by then. I had gone off to college in Denver and you weren't part of the formation of AmBoys or American Boys, that national organization that did the True Spirit conference.
The conference existed. I think it started in 96 or 97 and I came out as trans the next year or something. That already existed, but I did volunteer and work on the staff of that conference for at least 2 years, if not three.
Okay.
I know the last year I was definitely there, the year we got snowed out or snowed in, I guess is the best way to say that. Yeah.
Well,
that
maybe that's what it is. It's my recollection of hearing you talking about being involved in True Spirit Conference. I assumed that you were part of, did you form Desert Boys?
No, it was there before me.
It was
too.
There.
Yeah.
Nice.
I just keep showing up and these things are already there. People plant the seed and I help expand it until traction. And then I planted the seed and other people have helped grow it.
I started the Beach Boys Yahoo listserv because these were Yahoo listservs.
Right. That was in San Diego, right?
In San Diego. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was made the owner like the last, I don't know, the last decade of Bay Boys, B-A-B-O-Y-Z, Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area Boy. I was given the title of ownership. If they signed off and gave it to me, everybody who started it. So for like the last decade, it's sad. I was kind of sad to see that whole part of FTM community.
Oh my gosh.
Just vanish. Like the history, all of those notes. And right before everything stopped and was about to go away, I was contacted by a person who works at a digital archive, like a trans digital archive. And they asked for permission to grab up everything in there for the archival records. So they have it.
Oh, that's so that makes me happy because that was, like I said, before Facebook and everything, I was excited to go to conferences because I was going to get to meet some of these guys on these lists that I'd been emailing with so much or hearing from and telling their stories and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was
because there was a national FTM Yahoo group that I had been part of. I don't think I was ever a moderator. I doubt it. But I got in trouble once on that list from the moderators because I was about a year on testosterone and I asked the question, does anybody else have cramps? And it turns out I was told I wasn't had to ask those kinds of questions on the board.
Oh my, of course.
And that nobody has had that experience. They hadn't been moderated. I think they had people on moderated, so it never even made it to the wider audience. And come to find out, these uterine cramps are pretty common in our community. And if we had been able to talk about it back then, like 2000, what, six or seven?
Yeah, something like that.
It's a bummer.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Xander Kegg and his guest, Michael Woodward.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Xander Kegg and his guest, Michael Woodward. Let's pick up where they left off.
It was a bummer.
Right.
Okay, so music. I know that your music interest didn't end when you stopped being on the board of that women's music organization. You've had a band. Do you still have a band?
I don't have a band. And actually, music has always been a huge part of my life before and after transition. And if anything was going to stop me from transitioning, it would have been my voice or a fear of losing my voice. Because back then, this was before Joe Stevens was a thing, or there weren't any known trans men singers that I could find. The internet, like I said, wasn't very big. And so I was really worried. There was two other guys in my chorus who had transitioned ahead of me by a few months. And one of them, just, he really couldn't sing beforehand. So, you know, you got...
Between you and me.
Right, just between you and me and the listener. His singing was the one thing that I did appreciate about my life and my body. And if I had lost that ability to sing, I'm not sure what I would have done. But ultimately, I decided to take the risk because I finally found, I think it was Rafe up here in Seattle, who's no longer in Seattle. Hey, Rafe, if you're out there. So his voice changed and he was still able to sing and he was happy with it. And I'm like, okay, well, he did it. I can do it. And so that's when I went ahead and started. And I went from first soprano to second soprano to first alto to second alto to first tenor. Never went past first tenor. I'm still a first tenor. But just that whole experience, and that happened from January to October. So I went from the women's chorus, and then over the summer of my Melissa Etheridge years, and then I joined the men's chorus in the fall. So that was an interesting thing. After being in single voice or either men's choruses or women's choruses, I really decided I really prefer mixed choruses, which is why I love the chorus I'm in now, which is Puget Sound Works here in Seattle. And it's all gender chorus, and we get to sing fun stuff and hard stuff. And we have several trans women who are basses and one trans woman who's an alto. And it's just a really wide range of people. And it's fun, and everybody's a big family. And that's what I love about that. I do, however, miss being in a band and being the lead singer in a rock band, which was totally fun when I was in Tucson. Our band was called Too Much Information. Part of that was because half of us were trans and half of us weren't, but that was really too much information. We just loved making music together and had a good time. And I was in that band for, I don't know, like 12 or 13 years before I moved to Seattle. And I was the lead singer. I didn't play any instruments because everybody is better than me. So why should I bother? And I'll just stand here and sing and look pretty.
Yeah, I was going to say, get up in front.
Right? Somebody's got to do that. They can do the hard work. I'll just stand and sing. Anyway, when I moved up here, obviously I couldn't stay in that band. And then, well, the conference happened and all that stuff, and I was too busy. And then I went to California for a couple of years, and I'm back. So last year, I tried desperately, well, not super desperately, but I was really trying to put together a Bob Seger tribute band. Ooh. Because I can sing Bob Seger pretty well. He's in my range. I love his music. I'm not a huge fan, but he's a good match for my voice and about the same age, and felt like I could pull that off. But then it was like super impossible to get people together. And I'm not in the music scene here, so I don't know six people that play bass and all that. So I was trying to put out ads and then trying to find a rehearsal space. And of course, all the people I had were from all over the city. And the rehearsal space was in Ballard, but somebody else lived in Federal Way. And it was just crazy. And I had this right before my dad was dying, and there was just way too much. Maybe another time. This is not the right time. Yeah. So I'm not singing rock anymore. But
it'll come back.
When the timing's right, it'll work.
I think I was around 14 or 15 years old. I had been sent away to a school for juvenile delinquents. And I remember I was in my room and I turned on my stereo and on comes a song I fell in love with. And every time I hear it, I feel the same way, which is Turn the Page.
Oh, yeah.
By Bob Seger. And there's that one line, is that a woman or a man?
Yep.
And even then, I was a young lesbian. I was already out as lesbian to my family and not so much in the environment I was in. It was against the rules. Ooh, what an interesting line. Why does he say that? What does he mean? Then when I saw a picture of him, I'm like, oh, he has really long hair.
Right, yeah. You know?
But people used to, even when I was a teenager, people used to think I was a boy rather than a girl. And that happened to me all the way up until I transitioned. Funny story, I was about 6 to 8 months into transition, maybe closer to a year in transition, but living in Berkeley, California, where there have been many decades of training people to not sir masculine women.
Right.
And so because I was older, I was like 40 years old when I started transition, there was a slower process for me to sort of masculinize. My receptors in my body weren't as sensitive if I had been in my teens or 20s. And so I was about, I was close to a year on T, I think, at this point. And I went into this restaurant, order at the counter, and the guy turned to me and said, "What do you have, ma'am?" And I was like, oh, man.
Right.
Because I had been sirred my entire adolescence and then my 20s and 30s. And here I am. I'm finally doing it. And I got ma'amed. I was like, only in Berkeley. Only in Berkeley would that happen. Oh, my God. You mentioned Joe Stevens, the lead singer of the band that doesn't exist anymore, but their recordings are still available on the internet, Coyote Grace. I love that song. I don't remember the name of the song, but I remember that I like the song where he had a recording of himself pre-transition singing the song, and then he sang it many years post-transition with that beautiful, I refer to his voice when I tell people about it, James Taylor. James Taylor.
I call him like a whiskey tenor.
Oh, it's good. He spliced it together so that it's him in his female range and male range singing the same song like a duet. It's quite beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite creative. And also nowadays, what's interesting to me is that you mentioned being a butch and part of women's music, and that's part of your story. I talk about being part of Lesbian Avengers and the work, the things that I've been involved in, and Joe records a song, a duet with himself. It's like, that's not as common these days where people will acknowledge that they had an existence prior to transition, that it was as a man or a woman, regardless of whether we were gender conforming or not, straight or gay or whatever. People did see us in a particular way. We organized ourselves socially in a certain way. I enjoy having conversations with people who aren't shy about speaking about that history.
Yeah, well, I lived 36 years of my life before I transitioned, and I can't just say that never existed. And I don't have any shame about that part of my life. I felt ignorant and stupid that I didn't know anything, but I was also from Indiana, where you don't hear much about anything progressive. So if I felt shame about anything, it's like, okay, so I'm supposedly this big bad butch and I'm part of this organization that's super progressive around women. And it really was a struggle. So
it's all good. Definitely. So writing.
Yeah.
So in your bio, of course, you mentioned that you contributed the titled piece. So the book is Manning Up and your essay was Manning Up. And full disclaimer to the listener, I'm the editor or co-editor of the book Manning Up through Transgress Press. So do you remember what that book was originally going to be called?
Something very sterile.
It was Brotherhood is Powerful.
Oh, right, right.
Which is, it was based on this idea of sisterhood is powerful.
Right, yeah.
Right, and so like, well, there's a bunch of us who were lesbian feminists, radical separatists, dykes, and had been either directly or indirectly influenced by sisterhood is powerful. And so I was like, well, brotherhood can be powerful. But then your essay came in and I said, manning up. And then I read the story. I went to the co-editor, Mitch, I think we should retitle the book. Do you want to tell the listener a little bit about your story and what that means, manning up, where it came from?
Yeah. So Well, where it came from was from one of my therapists after I'd already moved to Tucson. So she was my first therapist in Tucson. And I was bemoaning some bad habit that I felt like I needed to quit and just was mostly just whining about it and everything and not doing anything about it. Michael, you just need to man up. And what? How dare you? You're gendering things and those things are not supposed to be gendered. And she's supposed to be this big shot gender therapist, the most revered in the Southwest or whatever. But what I came to realize after a lot of that and milling it over was she's really just needing to take responsibility and grow up a little bit and just kind of what we call now would be called adulting, I guess. But manning up is could be even more broader around not just applying to men because it is more getting too deep into gender. But manning up is, I guess, a maturation process is what we said in the book. And yeah. And so that's what my story is about is spending my first 36 years really lost and making it up as I went along and not necessarily being the nicest person and being deceitful and dishonest with people and cheating on my partners and just miserable and not knowing why. And I've felt like I had this shadow hanging over me all the time, and which turned out to be my masculine self. And once I figured all that out, well, there was a big step in between that actually, before I'm going through all this stuff, I finally just walk out on my relationship of how long we were together, quite some time, like 9 years or 7 years, something like that, which for me was a long time. And not really knowing why or what I was going to do next. But then I stumbled into this personal empowerment workshop called The Experience, which if the listener is familiar with EST, which was a big thing in the 80s, this was EST for queers. And it really helped me. It felt a little culty, but at the same time, it was also really helped me find my authentic self. And it involved, and I talk about this in the story that I wrote about when we got to the graduation part and they treated us to this makeover, right? And part of my whole process came down to that last night of preparing for the big graduation. They were trying to put me in this pantsuit and makeup and all this. What the f***? Give me a tie. As soon as I said that, the whole room just went, oh, right. And I still another 2 years or so before I met Holling and figured out the whole trans guy thing. But that was a turning point for me as far as really listening to myself and asking for what I needed and not being afraid to show my masculinity as a butch. And because I was trying to walk that fine line because I had a corporate job and it was Indiana. I didn't want to be afraid that somebody in their pickup trucks and follow me home and beat me to death or something. All those things that go through our mind. None of those things ever happened, but it's always there. And so it was.
I remember reading your essay and feeling there were a lot of similarities in our life experience because my father was an EST trainer. I went to Kids EST.
Okay.
Right? So my dad took me, if he was there for a weekend doing workshops, then he would enroll me in the kids workshop. But sometimes he would come and get me. And so I was around 10 years old when this first started to happen. My dad would come and get me and take me out of the kids workshop. And he'd bring me to the adult workshop. Uh-huh. And he would say, I want you to go up there on the stage and I want you to tell those people what it's like to be a child of the 70s. Right. Because we're talking late 70s at this point and in Los Angeles. And so at 10 years of age is when I got my first exposure to public speaking. And I really am so appreciative that my father took a kid who got sent home with talks too much in class notes from the teacher and said, well, then let's put this kid up on the stage and have them talk to the adults about what it's like. And I don't remember anything about it really, except just I can see myself, so to speak, in my mind's eye, not literally, of course, because I don't visualize, but I have this sense of I'm in front of a room and I'm talking to these people and they're enjoying it. And then I'd go back into the kids' workshop with Valerie Harper or some other. We had this whole B-list Hollywood people that were our workshop presenters.
Nice.
I didn't do the experience, but I did something very similar to that when I was older. That was
Landmark.
No, I didn't do Landmark. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was started by a gay man and his husband who had been in Landmark, Est and then
Oh, okay.
Landmark. They had gone through all the different levels, and then they decided they wanted to start something, and they did it in San Francisco. And so I'd say there was a significant number of LGBT people in these workshops, but it wasn't exclusively for them.
Got it.
And this was, trying to think, this was right before I started my transition. And I was at one of these workshops, and something that they do in these workshops is they divide the men and the women, right? And so you go off into separate rooms to have a separate kind of conversation to support each other, you know, this kind of stuff. And then you come back together, and there might be people who go up in front of the room and do a sharing. At one point, I stood up and I said, I'm going to stay in this room. And if there's anybody else who doesn't feel like they belong to the men's group or the women's group, you can stay with me in this room and we can have
Nice.
our own time together, work on the same activities. And there were a handful of people. And that was one of the first times I had done it in another workshop. And I thought, I'm going to try it again. It's interesting because when I just published a book recently, and the part of the title is The Third Space, and it comes from this action that I would do, which is I'm not going into either one of those rooms. I'm going to stay right here. I got this
Yeah.
third option. I'm cultivating, I'm creating it for anybody else who doesn't feel like those other spaces are the right space for them.
Right.
But I had not transitioned yet. I was calling myself trans. Actually, I think I called myself a tranny queer. People don't really say tranny that much anymore. I mean, I still do because I think it's funny, but taking testosterone, I wasn't there yet.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Kegg and his guest, Michael Woodward. We'll be right back.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Xander Kegg and his guest, Michael Woodward. Let's get back to where they left off.
I hadn't started it yet. It was probably about a year
Yeah.
later that I started it. But I rarely meet people that have had those experiences of going through those actualization or human potential or these different kinds of names for these workshops and how really beneficial they can be, even though they're a bit cultish. That there's still some good you can get out of it as long as
Absolutely.
you know exactly you have good boundaries and you say, I'm going to do this for this reason, but I'm not going to get sucked into the other stuff.
And there wasn't any other stuff to this one that I knew of, but it's just the way that it helped me get through the right and just really look at my life and my past and everything. And then I feel like that's why when I did discover trans men that it made so much sense. I didn't have to do all the other processing that some people have to do when they're like, oh my God, I'm trans. What does that mean? I'm gonna, and they stew on it for years and years. For me, it was like instantaneous. But my funny story with that is that so there was an annual retreat that was attached to this work, and so I went the first two or 3 years as my priest transition self, and I'm going to dead name myself here because it's part of the story. So at the retreats, we had to come up with a name that with an adjective attached. So my name as the first two retreats was Listening Lisa. And apparently I must have listened in between because I came back the last year as Morphing Michael. And so Morphing Michael is now my social media handle and who I've been all ever since then.
I always wondered where that came from. I love to hear that. And maybe
Morphing
I already
Michael.
knew that, but I had completely forgotten it. So it's fun to be reminded.
Right.
Speaking of manning up, for the listener, we recently celebrated our 10th anniversary of the publication of that book. It came out in
Right.
2014. And so for at Transgress Press, we brought together as many of the authors as we could, and we had a live event that was recorded. The video is, I think it might be done now being edited, and it should be hopefully soon available on the transgresspress.org website for people to go and just hear some stories and some updates from the authors on their life. So that was a lot of fun. And I was so happy that you were able to be there, especially because of the whole reason the book became titled Manning Home.
Right. And 10 years ago, we didn't have Zoom where we could all get together either. So it was nice to actually put some faces and some names that I've known the names forever. And some of them I'd met before, but a lot of them I had never met. So I'm like, oh, hey, that's who you are.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? You know, I remember right after before the book was published and I was telling somebody, it was a lesbian woman, about the name of the book, Manning Up. Well, can't you just call it something like Artemis Rising? And I'm like, that means the exact same thing. Manning Up and Artemis Rising are exact same thing.
Right.
You know,
but has a totally different ring to it. And it Artemis does. Rising sounds like something that a lesbian would call the book.
That's right.
Yeah. Not to judge my sister's thing. So, anyway.
I think there already is one with that title.
Yeah, probably. There probably is. It's probably an anthology of butches or something.
So we have been talking about so many different topics. We've got about 5 minutes remaining. Another thing that we have in common, and we don't have to get too in-depth. We don't really have enough time to get too in-depth, but you did mention that about your father. That's one of the things we have in common. My father passed months ago. He had dementia. I was his only child with my father. I have two half-sisters, but my father's only child. My parents divorced when I was 2 years old. So when he got dementia, he moved in with us, my wife and I, and he was with us for about a year and a half, almost 2 years before he needed to go into a higher level of care. Mm. I was his caregiver through that whole thing and durable power of attorney. And for people who have walked through being that close in that kind of a role with a loved one, whether it be a spouse or a partner or a parent with dementia, Alzheimer's, it's really challenging. And so it's always nice for me to be able to talk with other people who have had caregiving experiences that are at least similar to know what that is like. And so how long did your dad have to deal with? I forget what your father was
dealing
with.
He's my stepdad. He'd been my dad since I was 4 because my parents divorced when I was very young. He died when he was 87, but when he was about 80, 83 or so, he was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis. And then partway into that, then he got diagnosed with bladder cancer and with dementia.
For gosh sake.
I don't feel like his dementia was that bad as far as some cases.
It might not have been, it might not have progressed as far along because of the other.
Could be. Yeah. Illnesses. Yeah. I don't live in the same state as my family. Everybody else is still in Indiana. I don't understand the attraction, but I'm the only person in like 3 generations to leave. So I wasn't there all the time, but I probably spent more time in Indiana in the last 3 years than I did my whole adult life. So, and because now I'm supporting my mom too, who's going through a lot of the same stuff. It was difficult because he was not a real talkative guy anyway. He's very stoic, but he had a really dry sense of humor. When he was funny, he was really funny, but he mostly just didn't talk much. But he was brilliant. He was a master's of mechanical engineering and early computer programmer and all these things. And he was a great dad. And so when he started getting sick, it was hard. And I didn't, well, my birth dad, he died. My parents were already divorced, but when I was 17, I was still in high school. So I lost both my dads. But losing my stepdad was actually harder than losing my dad. Well, because he'd been a part of my life almost my whole life. And
yeah, day-to-day life, right?
Yeah, exactly. And was really foundational in the person I became as far as education and that kind of stuff. And it took me a long time to appreciate him because, well, lots of things. But kids often don't appreciate their parents until they're adults themselves.
Yeah. And, I think that's pretty normal.
Yeah. And he was so good to my mom and he loved her so much. They were divorced for 9 years because mom, well, I won't go into all that, but they got remarried later in life. And I think my mom now appreciates him a lot more than she did when he was still around.
Yeah.
He just wanted her to be happy. I know. And yeah, so
that's nice.
Yeah.
All the way to the end. Did he know you as Michael? Michael to him?
Okay. Yeah. I think I'm really fortunate in that. It took maybe about a year to get the names right on the packages for Christmas and things like that. But and the pronouns. And I've got the story of going to McDonald's with my dad and my brother, and the three of us are standing there, and the clerk says, "Can I help you, gentlemen?" And I just step right up there, and they both kind of look at each other like, "Oh, I guess this is really happening." Yeah.
Michael, it's been a fun trip down memory lane.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun, and I always look forward to talking to you.
We've reached the end of the Umbrella Hour. You've been listening to Xander Cagg and his guest, Michael Woodward. Until next time, thank you for listening.